This is Company Cars, the podcast that tries to make sense of the car business. Hello, and welcome to another episode of Company Cars. On this episode, I'm going to talk about this under-discussed phenomenon that's occurring in the automotive business. And it's a trend that's been continuing since the 2008 financial crisis, but has really accelerated in the past 2 years as a result of supply chain disruptions and chip shortages associated with the pandemic. And this issue is the death of the affordable new car. So over the past few years, we've seen the average transaction price for a new car rise from around $39,000 when this podcast began and to nearly $46,000 today. So even accounting for record inflation over the past 2 years, this is still especially breathtaking in a market environment where demand for new cars has continued unabated and most new cars arrive at dealerships pre-sold. So in this episode, I'll talk about a few reasons why the average transaction price for a new car has jumped so dramatically, why this issue has largely flown under the radar over the past decade, and my thoughts on how this will trend in the coming years. We also have another rental car roulette where I'm revisiting a previous rental car roulette and re-examining the Mazda CX-30. So I drove this new Mazda CX-30 on a longer distance drive than the last time, so we'll talk about how my thoughts have changed after driving this car a longer distance. So first question is, why is declining new vehicle affordability an issue? And I would say it's an issue for a couple reasons. One is, as new vehicles become more expensive, the potential pool of buyers that can afford a brand new car will start to shrink, and that's going to make the automakers much more sensitive to the buying patterns and economic circumstances of a smaller and smaller group of individuals. And so I think over the long run, this has potential implications for the automaker's business as they exit a lot of these lower end or more affordable segments of the market. I think the other issue is societal, and so oftentimes in places where people live, you need to have private transportation. And so for people that don't live in a major city with reasonable public transit like Boston or Chicago or New York City, oftentimes you may need a car to get around. And certainly you could drive a used car, but there are a lot of advantages to owning a brand new car versus a used car that especially people that make below the median household income would benefit from. And these benefits include lower cost of financing, more predictable maintenance costs, and more reliable vehicles. And so I think by having so many new vehicles tied up at the higher end segments or above the affordable range, I think it potentially has these unaccounted for societal consequences that we haven't really thought about. And so that's why I think it's important personally to have at least some selection in affordable new cars for this segment of buyer that may not feel comfortable buying a used car or maybe put it in a situation where buying a new car is the best possible outcome in terms of ensuring predictable transportation and predictable cash flows in terms of what they need to spend to keep basic transportation available to them. So a used car will often have much more unpredictable cash flows, and sometimes people may not be willing to take the risk of, say, a major mechanical failure happening in the next year or two. So having affordable new cars, I think, is very important in a market segment for a variety of reasons, and I think we all benefit when there's a good selection of entry-level new cars on the marketplace. So with that out of the way, let's now explore why new vehicle transaction prices have skyrocketed in recent years. And I think there's three main potential explanations here, one of which I think has a much bigger role than the other two. And so this is the shifting vehicle mix and consumer preferences for categories of vehicles, increasing safety and emissions regulations that have required additional equipment and made vehicles more complex, and also the increasing longevity and reliability of modern automobiles. So let's start right out of the gate with what I think is the single biggest explanation for why costs have skyrocketed for a new car. And that's the shifting vehicle mix and consumer preferences for categories of automobiles. So I've hinted at this and talked about it in other episodes, but I'm going to attack it head on here. And I think the single biggest explanation for why the average cost of a new vehicle has skyrocketed is the shifting mix of new vehicles that consumers are buying and that automakers are selling. And by a shifting mix, I mean this march from sedans and coupes and wagons into crossovers, SUVs, and pickup trucks. So as the default vehicle that most of us purchase has shifted from a compact or midsize sedan into a compact or midsize SUV, these crossovers and SUVs that we're substituting into are larger, more expensive, and more profitable than the vehicles that we're substituting away from. And so in one of the early episodes of the podcast, we talked about how crossovers have caused a large shift in the new vehicle market, and this shift is one of the big contributors to the rise in new vehicle prices. So for example, as shoppers shift from buying a Corolla to buying a Toyota RAV4, that RAV4 is also much more expensive than the comparable Corolla that it replaces. And this phenomenon feeds on itself over time. So as consumers substitute away from sedans to crossovers, automakers have responded by slowly exiting the business of selling traditional cars or those compact and mid-sized family sedans. And this can happen in subtle ways. So what happens is the automakers first, because they see declining consumer demand, they'll shrink the number of options available on cars. And so you may only have a few things you can choose from on a car, but you can choose from a much wider palette of features on a comparable compact SUV. This causes even more consumers to shift from the car to the SUV because the SUV has more available features that fit more lifestyles. And then this results in the automaker responding to that shift and further shrinking the combinations on the sedan that you can buy, where you finally, the logical conclusion of all this is the automaker exits those product lines completely. So in recent years, Ford, GM, and Chrysler in particular have exited the business of selling compact sedans and hatchbacks, and then slowly exited the business of selling midsize sedans and coupes. So there's fewer competitors in the marketplace, but this has also shifted the average retail price of the products that they do offer. So if we look at Ford, for example, 10 years ago, they had a Ford Focus, a Ford Fiesta, and a Ford Fusion in the cars category. So you could choose a subcompact, a compact, or a midsize. They also sold a Taurus full-size family sedan. So these prices ranged from about $12,000 for the Fiesta to about $30,000 to $35,000 for the Taurus, and then lots of choices in between. If we look at their lineup today, their product lineup starts with the $20,000 and up Ford EcoSport, which in many ways is actually smaller than the Fiesta it replaces, and I would argue not as good of a car, but now the price ladder starts with about $20,000 to $21,000 for the EcoSport and runs as high as $85,000, $90,000, or $100,000 for the Expedition. And so there's much more range in the pricing capabilities of the SUV and truck lineup at Ford relative to the sedan lineup. And over the years, as consumers moved from Focuses to Escapes and Fusions to Explorers, then Ford slowly trimmed back those products to where they didn't have them anymore. And what happens is this is really good for the automaker's profitability over time, but now Ford doesn't really sell any brand new cars under about $22,000 or $23,000 retail price when the entry point is an EcoSport. So they're exiting these segments and it's increasing their profitability because if we're being honest, that Fiesta or Focus historically was not particularly profitable anyway, but the downside to Ford as the automaker is that they're losing this entry point to bring in younger buyers or buyers at the beginning of their car buying journey into the company. By starting relatively high, they're still starting their lineup within maybe a few thousand dollars of Toyota, Honda, Hyundai, and Nissan, all of whom still sell compact sedans. But at that end of the market, a price gap of a couple thousand dollars can be extremely material. And so that can be the difference between getting a first-time car buyer into your brand and engaged with the brand and losing them to a competitor. And so while their profitability is great right now, it means consumers have fewer choices in the affordable end of the market, and a lot of these automakers are giving up the opportunity to cater to that first-time new vehicle buyer. And so while some customers can substitute into the automaker's more expensive offerings, so say from a Focus to an Escape, other customers are leaving the brand. And so What's interesting here is market-wide, though, we're seeing this shift where we're seeing this shift into crossovers and SUVs at a far higher rate than we are seeing new vehicle buyers enter the market. And so that is the single biggest thing that's driving this huge spike in new vehicle transaction prices. So to sum up what I've said in this first reason, it's that we have this shifting vehicle mix both from the automakers and the consumers, and there's a feedback effect of all of this that multiplies on itself, where now most people will say, oh, I want a small SUV, and they won't think about the potential sedan options, which drives them to spend more and then drives automakers to sell even fewer compact sedans and midsize sedans. So having talked about the primary explanation for why vehicle prices have jumped so much in recent years, I did want to take a moment to talk about two additional smaller reasons that are still nonetheless important. And the first is the increasing longevity and reliability of modern automobiles. So another reason why cars are becoming more expensive over time is that cars are lasting longer. So 30 years ago, it wouldn't be reasonable to expect cars to last much more beyond 15 years and 120 to 150,000 miles. So if we think back to the 80s, Toyota really built their reputation on cars that lasted more than 100 to 120,000 miles on average. But today in a modern car, it's pretty reasonable to expect it to go 200,000 miles without major issues as long as you've been keeping up with the maintenance. And the average vehicle is close to 12 years old in the US. And so we're keeping our cars longer as a reflection of increased prices, and cars themselves are starting to show that they have a longer useful life than cars from maybe 20 or 30 years ago. And this longer expected useful life has led to improved residual values over time, especially later in the vehicle's life, which has helped consumers to offset some of the sting of a higher upfront purchase price, but has also demonstrated that maybe we actually are getting something of value in exchange for these rapidly increasing prices, because instead of getting a car that only lasted us 10 to 15 years, now we're getting a car that could easily go 20, 25 years of normal use and still be fine. The other thing that's happening is in recent years, we've seen increased safety and emissions regulations that have required additional equipment, maybe. And so these complex innovations in powertrain efficiency and safety advancements like direct injection gasoline engines, side curtain airbags, stability control, have all required substantial upfront R&D investment, and automakers need to be able to sell profitable cars to continue to invest in these advancements as time passes. So, for example, cars sold through the 2000s and 2010s, the profits from selling those cars were invested in the current generation of safety and powertrain advances that we see today, including forward collision warning, vehicle structural engineering, and improved safety systems. So in recent years, what's been interesting is as prices as cost of developing this technology has gone up, prices for vehicles have increased, you may see a lot of information out there about how on an inflation-adjusted basis, a lot of cars are less expensive today than they were, say, in the 1990s or 2000s. And that may be true, but one thing I would like to point out is wage growth has not necessarily grown at the rate of inflation over the same time period. And so even though the car today may be less expensive on an inflation-adjusted basis than the same car 20 years ago, our incomes have not kept up with inflation in many cases. And so in that sense, the affordability of the same car, even though it's less expensive in real terms today, may still be lower because our incomes haven't grown at the same rate as inflation. So those are just two additional things that might be the primary explanations for why cars are getting more expensive. But the big one is that we've seen this shifting vehicle mix and consumer preferences that has created this feedback loop on itself over time that's led to a more expensive mix of vehicles in the marketplace. And now it's time for a short break. We'll hear from our sponsors and we'll share some information about how to submit a listener question. The Company Cars podcast is sponsored by Rejected Conjectures Incorporated, a division of Integrated Derivatives. If you have a question that you want answered on the show, write us an email at companycarspodcast@gmail.com. Why has this issue largely flown under the radar since the financial crisis? So, as the average new car has become more expensive and larger over time, how come we haven't seen a consumer revolt, and how come we haven't seen shoppers just choose not to buy a new car? So, I'll talk about two reasons that have helped to blunt the effect of escalating vehicle prices. And the first is financial engineering and innovative financing. And the first trend that's helped to blunt this effect of more expensive cars has been new financing schemes that have helped to keep increases in monthly payments low relative to increases in the price of the car. So specifically, I'm talking about a relatively low interest rate environment over the past 10 years and rapidly increasing loan term length. So the average vehicle loan term has gone from about 60 months to around 72 months and is now slightly over 72 months, which means it's increasingly common to get 84 and 96 month loans. And on some cars, you can even get a 108 month loan if it's very expensive, which is crazy. So these are long-term loans, pretty close to a mortgage in terms of how much of the useful life of the vehicle it may cover. And when you put this together with historically low interest rates over the past decade, this has allowed car shoppers to keep up with the rapidly increasing prices on new cars, even if their incomes haven't moved at the same pace as the price. So every time somebody goes back to buy a new car, switching to a marginally longer loan term between purchases has helped manufacturers and dealership blunt the effect of escalating vehicle prices. So they've been able to hide some of that price increase in these longer loan terms, which is really innovative, but there's only so much more you can do that, right? So we could go from a 108-month loan to a 120-month loan, but at some point, people won't want to have a super crazy loan term that's just as long as maybe a mortgage to be able to buy a car. I think the other innovation that we're seeing is, for a while, leasing was extremely popular, and so leasing kind of comes in ebbs and flows based on what's in vogue at the time. So leasing had this huge renaissance in the 90s, and then it has rebounded again in the mid to late 2010s. And leasing also allows people to get into a more affordable price for the same vehicle, because in a lease, you only pay for the portion of the vehicle that you use, or the depreciation over the first couple years of the vehicle's life. So these financing innovations have allowed us to mitigate these effects, but one thing I'm concerned about is we're potentially running out of levers to pull here, but maybe there will be further financing innovations, such as being able to Airbnb your car on Turo, for example, or as Elon Musk has said, he wants to create a autonomous driving service that is the combination of Uber and Airbnb for Tesla owners. And so you can imagine, if you own a Tesla or you buy a Tesla and you can rent it out on the days that you're not using it, that may also help you justify the very high purchase price of a Tesla, for example. So in the future, we may see more innovative financing models that help with vehicle affordability, even as prices keep climbing. And the other explanation that's allowed us to kind of brush this issue under the rug is that the constrained supply chain has helped blunt the impact, because automakers have prioritized their limited materials for the most expensive and profitable products in their lineup. And so this is actually a big cause of why prices have gone up as well, which has pushed up the average transaction price. But it has also forced the market to prioritize who needs a new car right away. So the people that are buying new cars right now tend to be the people that cannot afford to wait, or can't wait because they totaled a previous car or something, so their willingness to pay is much higher. So we are basically filtering out this buyer pool of people who are least price sensitive right now, because anybody who's extremely price sensitive and can wait is waiting to buy a new car for the most part. And so this has helped to further exacerbate the problem in some senses, because automakers are now only making their most profitable vehicles with the limited supplies of materials they have. But also the shoppers that are in the market right now largely can't afford to wait, or can't afford to care about super high prices. So you may know that prices are really high right now, but if you just totaled your car in an accident and you need transportation to get to work, then you really may not necessarily have a choice on when you choose to buy a car. And so that's the other reason why we haven't heard quite so much about vehicle affordability lately, because the buyers that are in the market are not necessarily a representative sample of a typical market environment. And so the real question now is, will this trend abate in the coming years? And I think it's unclear, because as automakers shift their lineup towards electric vehicles, we actually may see transaction prices shift even higher for a brief period, because currently electric vehicles sell for a premium above their gasoline counterparts. But as the EV technology matures and electric vehicles proliferate through the lineup, there's actually huge economies of scale tied with producing electric vehicles. We may start to see this trend of rising transaction prices abate as lower-priced EVs enter the lineup. So, for example, this year, GM announced that they were cutting the price of the Chevy Bolt EV to make room for more expensive EVs in its lineup. And with the new federal tax credit that might be coming, the Chevy Bolt may once again be one of these like around $20,000 cars that you could purchase, whereas Chevy, the brand, hadn't really had much around $20,000 in recent years. And so we may see things come full circle, and then also when supply finally catches up with demand, hopefully over the next year or two, we'll see automakers start to produce the full portfolio of their lineup again, instead of having to prioritize their most profitable vehicles. So by having their whole portfolio of cars available, then that'll also help with abating this trend of rapidly escalating vehicle prices. So it's hard to say, because on one hand, EV technology could mature and prices could come down, because producing those cars has lots of opportunities for economies of scale. And also on the gasoline car side, as we come out of the chip shortage, hopefully in the next year or two, automakers will go back to being able to produce everything in their lineup, and that should help. But on the other side, we've seen that electric vehicles tend to be, on average, more expensive than their gasoline counterparts, even today. And so with the notable exception of things like the Chevy Bolt, the Hyundai Kona, the Kia Niro EVs, most EVs are positioned kind of much more on the more expensive side and in more SUVs and trucks than in regular cars. So we'll see. I mean, I hope so. I hope things abate, because sometimes it gets really hard to find a car that's a good fit for somebody that maybe doesn't have a lot of money to spend but needs something to be reliable and efficient and predictable in its cost profile. And so I'm thinking of people who are trying to spend between $10,000 and $15,000 for a car, and it's really difficult to find something that's in reasonably good shape and that won't have a ton of upcoming maintenance expenses to go. And so I'm kind of hoping that we'll see some more affordable new cars soon. So maybe there's a market gap here for an automaker to try to fill in. And now it's time for Rental Car Roulette. All right, so on this episode of Rental Car Roulette, we are revisiting a car that I've reviewed on a previous iteration of Rental Car Roulette. Only this time, I drove it long distances instead of driving it primarily around town. So I think it's worth revisiting because the use case was very different. And the vehicle I rented was a Mazda CX-30, 2.5S Select, to be specific. So it was one above the base model. And this was a similar configuration to what I had on the previous episode of Rental Car Roulette. This is a pretty popular configuration of Mazda CX-30 in general and in rental car fleets. So this one was about the same age as the previous one. So it had about 15,000 miles on the odometer and was about 6 to 8 months old. And so it had kind of been around the block for a little bit. And I drove this car primarily on the interstate. I was doing a one-way rental between two cities, and this car was a pretty good road trip car. I think in town, this car is excellent because it's a really nice size, it's easy to park, but one thing that bothered me a little bit was the visibility. It was a little bit hard to see out the back in this car, and out on the open road, the limited visibility is slightly less of an issue, especially with blind spot monitoring that helps monitor your blind spots as you're changing lanes. And This car's adaptive cruise control was quite good, worked really well. It was nice for a long distance drive. The car did have a little bit road noise than what I would prefer for a long distance drive, but at about $25,000, it still remains a lot of car for the money and had all the basic features I was looking for. So it had Apple CarPlay, Android Auto, all the advanced driver assistance features, blind spot monitoring, and had a really well put together interior. So I also averaged about 30 miles a gallon, which it's not terrible, but it's not extremely high, but it was about average for a compact SUV with all-wheel drive. And I think the size of the car for a road trip is perfect for 1 to 2 people. So the back seat is pretty tight, and I don't think I would put adults back there for a cross-country road trip, and I don't think a rear-facing child seat would fit behind most drivers, even though it probably would have fit behind me. So I don't know if this is a great car for families, but for a person or a couple or 2 people traveling, I think it's the perfect size, especially if you're planning to stay in hotels primarily on a road trip or you're using this for your day-to-day driving. And so I think this experience reaffirmed my earlier verdict on the CX-30, that it's an especially compelling subcompact SUV for people who want some of the practicality of a hatchback or an SUV body style, but don't need or want the extra space that's in a CR-V, a RAV4, or a Mazda CX-5 from one category larger. And so even though it's not that much less expensive than the CX-5, especially in the higher trim levels, I could see where somebody would prefer the smaller size of the CX-30 in terms of parking and maneuverability around town. So I think the CX-30 in particular has a really wide spectrum in terms of how many features you can get in the car. So this car was near the bottom of the trim ladder, as we say in the car business. And so it was about $25,000, but I think you can option this car up all the way up to $37,000 or $38,000. And at that price point, the car becomes much less compelling because for $36,000 or $37,000, you can buy a car from the category up. And I think at that price point, I probably would sacrifice some of that maneuverability to get the roomier interior of a CR-V or Toyota RAV4 or Mazda CX-5. So if I were buying a Mazda CX-30, I would stick to the lower trim levels for the best value. I would try to keep it under $30,000 if I could. But at under $30,000, I think it's a pretty compelling value. And the second time of driving this car, I think just further confirmed my thoughts on that. And so in this subcompact SUV segment, I think it'd probably be where I would start my shopping journey for a subcompact SUV. All right, and that's going to wrap it up for this episode of Company Cars. Thank you for listening, as always. And if you have any questions, write us at companycarspodcast@gmail.com. Thanks.